I got a serious question for you. Are you happy? And I mean that. I'm not being sarcastic or tongue-in-cheek. Are you happy? Our Declaration of Independence says we have the right to pursue happiness. How is that going? Are you happy? I'm Christina Cook. You're listening to The Christina Cook Show. And I'm asking this question probably a bit unadvisedly so soon after some disastrous election returns here in Colorado. Nationwide, not too bad for conservatives. Of course, we've got Matt Bevin, who is the new governor of Kentucky, and Kentucky looks like it's going to head really conservative. I mean, it's tilting really red, which is great. They've got a new lieutenant governor who's also a Tea Party conservative. Interestingly, a black Tea Party conservative. So, I don't know how they continue to try to hang this racist thing on us, but they do. But, you know, nationwide, not too bad. Here in Colorado, not so great. So perhaps forgetting Tuesday, are you happy? And I want to ask you this because of the far-reaching implications that have been coming to mind this afternoon. I found this great article on thefederalist.com by a guy named Ben Dominic. And the name of the article, The Crisis of the American Working Class, is a really interesting analysis of why Donald Trump is reverberating so loudly throughout the American electorate right now. And it all does come back to culture. You know, this culture politics thing, it goes both ways. You know, public policy and how our government actually structures, especially economics, is going to have an effect on our culture. It's going to have an effect on our national happiness. I mean, truly, that does not mean that they should legislate from that perspective, except to get the heck out of our way. That would make me delighted. That would increase my happiness index by orders of magnitude. We'll just put it that way. And probably yours too. But I want to point out that this does swing both ways, that the government policies have an effect on our actual lives and how we perceive our lives and really, honestly, on our happiness. The crisis of the American working class, I want to kind of walk you through the logic on this article. And then I want to talk to you about some research that I did that kind of begins to really explode a lot of this stuff. Well, first of all, let's remember, you know, there's actually been a ton of research done on happiness itself. Dr. Arthur Brooks of the American Enterprise Institute has done a lot of research and a lot of writing about this very subject and its relationship to work, because work is really one of the four components of happiness. Surprise, surprise. We've been told that it's this drudgery and it's punishment and it's this, you know, thing that we really should be doing without, and everybody should just be living high on the hog with unicorns and glitter. But work is one of the four components of what actually does make us happy. Applying our passion to our skills and feeling like we're providing value to society. That's really what work is. It's earned success, right? That's a component of happiness. There's three other components. They have to do with faith, family, and community. So you take work, faith, family, and community. You have the four major components of happiness. And I know that I've been talking about self-esteem, and I've been sounding a little bit like I'm becoming a psychologist. I really don't mean to do that. It's just this whole world of culture opening up for me is really kind of bringing a bunch of really interesting stuff together for me. So that's why I've been kind of looking at some of this. But this on this podcast, I want to talk about the why of politics. You know, we're talking about the why. Why does this stuff matter? Why is it important for us to be involved in this and to look at both sides of this equation? Look at culture, look at politics, and look at how these things come together. And work is one of those areas where it most definitely does come together. This is impacting your life, your daily life, and not just your paycheck, not just how much money you take home or what job you can do or how many regulations you have to follow while you're there, whether or not you can start a business. All of that is part of it as well. Particularly from this article, I want to talk about something that's going to sound very strange when I say it, disability. I want to talk about the disability and the Social Security disability stream and the increase, which is this deadly, deadly increase in the number of people who are on disability. This is disproportionately affecting the lowest tier, economic tier of folks in our country, of workers in our country. And think about people who have less than 12 years of formal education, people who either don't have a high school degree or that's all they've got is a high school degree. And that is, you know, from an educational standpoint, that does limit in this country now in 2015, limits the amount of upward mobility. It limits the types of jobs you can do. It limits a lot of things economically for you. But it always used to be, and you go back, and Charles Murray covers a lot of this in his book, Coming Apart, which is just it's a fabulous read, especially if you like statistics, if you like really hard data. Coming Apart is a great look from a statistical standpoint at what's happened in our country since 1960. In both the top 20% tier and the bottom 30% tier of our country and what that means for our communities. But you look at this bottom 30% tier and look at the disproportionate effect of disability expansion. What's happened is between... Well, and in this article, he talks about the difference between 1999 and 2014. So we've got a 15-year span. During that period, those who were disabled between the ages of 46 and 55, for example, increased from about 15% to about 20%. Now, before you go, well, that doesn't sound like that big of a jump. That's a rise of almost 30% right there. It was at 15 and added another 5%. Now, I mean, a 30% increase in 15 years, that's saying a lot. That is saying a lot of what's going on. And the part of the problem is, and part of the reason, part of the driving force behind this, is that they have really opened up the Social Security and disability payments to folks who have what they're calling musculoskeletal and mental health disabilities. They've really kind of decrease the entry requirements for that, the eligibility requirements under those two areas, so that it's almost more of a yes, I have it, and there's nothing for you to diagnose, so just take my word for it, and they accept that in Social Security and SSDI. So if that's the case, I mean, that's an increase, like I said, of over 30% in the course of 15 years. Disability, being on disability, is linked to your education level. It's linked to trying to get, it's curiously linked to the reform of welfare, where President Clinton shuffled off a lot of the cost for welfare to the states, and then the states had to bear that cost. So, of course, they're desperately trying to get people off of welfare. Well, if they could get people off of welfare and into disability, they saved themselves the cost of the welfare and put the cost for the disability 100% back on the federal government. And so it's curious that from 1995 until 2010, you see the welfare rolls nationwide go down and the disability rolls go up by almost the exact same amount. Kind of funny that, isn't it? Unintended consequences. And so between loosening the diagnostic requirements for pain and back pain and for mental illness, the welfare reform from President Clinton, and having this ceiling put on you because of a lack of education, this is America's working class, and these are the conditions that they're functioning under. And so now you've got folks who have been working and who traditionally, if you go back, and Murray covers this in his book, you go back and you look at what the culture was within the working class for, you know, majority of this nation's history. And, you know, there was still a strong family community. There was still a strong family institution, not a lot of divorce. There were communities built around those families to raise those kids. There was an attitude towards work that said that if you were an able-bodied man, then you needed to be working. Otherwise, there was a huge stigma attached to that. And they had faith communities. They had faith. They had all of those aspects. And so it wasn't a stellar existence, but prior to the war on poverty and all of these things that people have tried to do and administrations have tried to do to make people, quote unquote, happier, have had the exact opposite effect. Isn't that interesting? Law of unintended consequences. Now, I don't know why necessarily faith is being destroyed. I don't know necessarily why, except I know that there are some perverse incentives built into our economics to destroy the family. But, you know, social mores have also changed. And in terms of both faith and family, in that, you know, it's now celebrated for women to be single mothers. And to all the single mothers who are listening, I do admire you. I truly do. I don't know how you do it. I certainly couldn't. It places more burdens on the adults in a society to have to deal with that on a collective basis. You know, when we're dealing with, you know, 30-40%, some places 60% birth out of wedlock, and we're seeing the effects of that collectively. You know, nobody intended these effects, but we're seeing the effects of it collectively throughout our society. And so we've got the family falling apart. We've got people, 59 million people by some estimates, who are not religious. They are not affiliated with a faith community. That is the largest category right behind evangelical Protestantism. And it outranks both mainline Protestants and Catholics. The number of people who don't have a church is greater than the number of either mainline Protestants or Catholics. Think about that for a second. That's a huge, huge group. People who don't believe in something bigger than themselves. So we've got both of those things being annihilated, especially within the working class. And then on top of that, you know, the communities which are built around faith and family are being destroyed. And now we've got people, an increasing number of people, who are going on disability. They're consigning themselves to $1,200 to $1,400 per month. Almost none of them re-enter the workforce. Almost nobody, like less than 1% of the people who go on disability later re-enter the workforce. So this is like a life sentence that people are actually choosing for themselves. This is a life sentence for poverty. No wonder they're hopeless. No wonder they're hopeless. So let's think about it. You know, this is 30% of our country, a third of our country, that is dealing with some or most of these effects, not 30% who are on disability, but 30% of our country that is living within working class communities such as they are, that are trying to deal with all of these social effects. They're not happy. They're obviously not happy. They're hopeless. And they're angry. I would be too. I am. I mean, I'm angry just watching some of the stuff that happens. I don't fit into those categories, but I'm angry, and they've got to be furious. I mean, this is not the America that they were promised when they were kids. This is not America at her best. This is America at her worst. And so with that hopelessness and anger, is it any surprise that somebody who is willing to stand up and tell it straight, who is willing to throw off the PC shackles, who is willing to stand in front of the country and say things that no other candidate has ever said before, is gaining, you know, has such huge popularity? Donald Trump has really, really hit a nerve. He's really hit something that people wanted to hear because they wanted to hear straight talk. Of course, the slogan of his campaign is Make America Great Again. Not entirely original. Reagan had something similar. But it's something that people want to hear. So make it great again. It's one of those things, That's one of those slogans, and I guess most of the campaign slogans sort of fit into this, but it's sort of fill in your own blanks, you know? I mean, it doesn't really say what's wrong with America and what they're going to change, but, you know, we're going to fill in our own blanks and you make it into what you want. Sort of like Hope and Change. Sort of the same deal. And it was the brilliance of Hope and Change was fill in your own blanks. Well, Make America Great Again says, you know what? It's not great now. It's not great now. We recognize that reality. We recognize that that's what's going on. We recognize what you're going through, working class America. I recognize exactly what you're dealing with. And we're going to fix that. We're going to bring manufacturing jobs back. We're going to stop the disintegration of your communities and the infiltration by immigrants who are not here legally. We're going to stop a lot of the decline and the bad policies that are affecting your everyday life. We're going to turn this around, change it around, and make America great again. It's not a surprise to me why he is having such a huge effect. It's really not. And I think it's worth pondering exactly what the socioeconomic factors are that have created an America where a Donald Trump is polling at 30%. Those are the factors that we need to work on if we're going to talk about working on the culture. The things that have made America responsive to Donald Trump are the things that we need to fix. And that's irrelevant who's sitting in the Oval Office. Those are the things we need to fix. So that was that's my two cents for the evening. This is, you know, it's part of trying to just put things back together and trying to find, I mean, I feel like I'm trying to herd cats right now because there's so many different ideas and so many directions I could be going. And I want to try to pull all this together into something that seems cohesive. So thank you for going on this journey with me. I really appreciate it. Just remember until tomorrow, America is great because Americans are great. So go out there and be exceptional. We'll be right back.